That's the one that comes to.
Good afternoon, and it's about 1:10, and this is the meeting of Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division. Happy St. Patrick's Day. First bill up, Senate File 35, Senator Vickerman. Senator Vickerman, this has to do with Area 2 Minnesota River Basin Projects, Incorporated Floodplain Management Appropriation. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for allowing me to come before you today and try to see if we can keep this project going. We've been doing this for a long time. I have an expert witness with me today who can... Actually, what we need is $140,000 in fiscal year 2010, $140,000 fiscal year 2011. But I know money is short. So when we get through this, and hopefully members will go through it, I'm going to ask that we lay this on the table for possible inclusion just until we see if we can find some funding. So if you would introduce yourself.
I will. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Carrie Netsky, and I'm the coordinator for Area 2 Minnesota River Basin Incorporated. Can you hear me?
Well, we can. Welcome. Okay. Welcome to the meeting. Go ahead. Committee, go ahead.
I am here today on behalf of Senate File 35, where we're requesting the continued funding of $140,000 annually for our work that involves floodplain management within nine counties of southwestern Minnesota. Before you, there's a short booklet that I brought up today summarizing our purpose and the work that our organization does within that realm of flood control. You may go ahead and look at that book at your leisure. I'll just go ahead and I'll speak about our 31-year history of that service that we provide to those nine counties and the state of Minnesota. Area 2's approach to flood control over those 31 years has been to stop the water where it falls and to construct projects in a stair-step fashion down the Buffalo Ridge. The ridge is most famous for all the wind turbine generators being built upon it. But what makes the Buffalo Ridge so enticing is the elevation differences. Somewhere up to 80 feet per vertical drop per mile in the Lacaparral River, and it goes down to about 50 feet per mile of drop in the Redwood River watershed. In contrast to the Red River Valley, where there's just several feet of fall per mile, you can see that there's a drastic difference in the flooding that happens in our area of the state. Due to these very steep slopes, rainfall and snow melt gain extreme erosive forces, and that makes flooding basically an annual nightmare for people who live there and try to make a living from that land. Area 2's proven approach allows for landowner-friendly and voluntary solutions to control those erosive forces of floodwaters while we further reduce the damage to stream banks that are adding sediments and nutrients to already impaired waters. Recent studies indicate that 65% of the sediment in Lake Pepin are from stream bank erosion. And from if you're familiar with southwestern Minnesota, you'll realize that that is a very true statement. This region in Minnesota has a long history of flooding, dating all the way back to 1916 when the Corps of Engineers investigated flood control efforts on the main stem of the Yellow Medicine River. You might ask why our organization has a 31-year history. The five major watersheds within Area 2 suffer from a very unique and a secondary form of flooding called crossover flooding. Not only do our floodwaters run down that Buffalo Ridge northeast to the Minnesota River, but it also, because of the steep slopes, it actually can skip watershed boundaries. So it basically flows from Ortonville to Mankato, skipping one watershed kind of in a stair-step fashion on down. So essentially, our flooding dilemmas are twofold. The reason for my testimony today is to explain our continued need of administrative funding. If I may, I'd like to draw your attention to the fourth page of your booklet that I provided you. It's noted by a pink tab, and that is a graph entitled State Funding Synopsis. This graphically illustrates the past funding of appropriations that we've received, both administrative and for project funding, over the past 13 years. Administrative funding that I'm talking about today is illustrated by the yellow bars. Dating back to 1978, when the Area 2 organization was created by statutes, $250,000 in annual funding for administration and construction of projects was provided by the state of Minnesota. That amount continued through about the mid-'80s when it was reduced to $189,000, which was still an adequate amount to achieve the organization's intent. That funding level remained until 2001, when the Ventura administration made efforts to eliminate all joint powers organizations. Of the 10 joint powers boards at that time, only three survived, of which Area 2 is one of them. Several of the reasons for our survival is, number one, that we were created by statute, and we're also seen as a regional authority for managing those floodwaters within our area of the state. Survival meant a 25% cut to the administrative funding from $189,000 to $140,000 per year. In 2003, another 25% cut to $105,000 annually was endured. That was basically a 45% total cut within a two-year period. The member counties remained committed and continued to provide the 25% match of that original $189,000, contributing over $85,000 a year towards the administration and the continuance of the Area 2 organization. In 2007, we were successful, and we did get an increase back up to the $140,000 funding level. An additional strain to our budget is the lack of a professional engineer that is mentioned in statute to be provided by the state. The former engineer retired in 1998 and was never replaced due to budget constraints. Area 2 now hires consulting engineering services, and that consumes another chunk out of our already wavering administrative budget. Area 2 has successfully proven that it can do more with less, as budget cuts have required us to do. This long-standing, successful, and beneficial partnership between Area 2 and the state of Minnesota needs to continue, as the purpose and the need are the same, very much as it was 31 years ago. By doing our part to reduce the flood damages and keeping the sediments and nutrients on the land and out of the waters, we are bettering the Minnesota River and the Mississippi River for generations to come. I thank you for your consideration of our request, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Nitzke. Yes, Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, administration's new plan is we should coordinate and work together. And nine counties compromised this put together. And when you think down in where I live, it's water don't run, the water does run. You get up by Canby, it could go straight down. We don't have the massive floods like you have in Redwood or the Red River Valley and those, but we do have floods. It was a flood by Marshall over Highway 59. So
how's it going this year, Senator? Go ahead,
Mr. Chair. This year's actually been pretty good. We've had some, you know, rather warm weather, but at night it's getting down to freezing, so it's kind of slowing them up, melting during the day and slowing. So far things are good. Just driving up here from Marshall this morning, the ditches are pretty much plumb full, but everything is within the ditches at this point.
Excuse me, Senator. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead if you're...
I'm done.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if there's no more questions, then I would move that recommend the passage of Senate File 36 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. The only reason I say that is, you know, I don't have $140,000. We may have to shift around to find that kind of money. So it's a worthwhile project. We're going to do quite a bit of that this year, I think. We're going to have to just include it, and hopefully we can find some money to move around. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File number 35 be recommended to pass and for possible inclusion in the bill.
Okay. All right. Senator Vickerman moves that to Senate File 35 be passed and laid on the table for possible inclusion. We don't have a quorum just yet, Senator Vickerman, so we'll take care of that as soon as Senator Anderson gets here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair.
So at this point, we're going to open this committee to public testimony on the governor's recommendations. And the first person we have to give testimony on the list is Steve Morse from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We'll take care of that.
John, I got some too. Number two. Handout number three.
Senator, you want to introduce the people you have up there, too, and then we'll just kind of let you go along, or?
I would be happy to, yeah. And what we'll do is kind of got them in order here, and you can ask questions whenever you'd like. But I'm Steve Morris, Executive Director of Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We have Paul Hoffman, who is the Advocacy Director for Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. We have Daryl Gerber, who is with the Water Program at Clean Water Action. And John Tuma, who is a lobbyist. He works with both Minnesota Environmental Partnership and Conservation Minnesota. And today the name on the agenda is Cheryl Appledorn. We know she's a lot smaller, but he's kind of the Cheryl Appledorn testifying on behalf of Conservation Minnesota.
She's also a lot smarter, too. Sure.
All right. Senator, go ahead.
Okay, great. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I did provide a handout, and you'll notice we put a special green cover on it for the day-to-day for those of you of Irish heritage. And maybe some of you have seen this before. This is the collaborative agenda for Minnesota Environmental Partnership for this year. And particularly what we're going to be talking about is the Safeguarding Investments for Minnesota Futures, which is on page 8 and 9 in the book. As many of you know, Minnesota Environmental Partnership is a coalition of more than 80 environmental conservation nonprofits here in the state of Minnesota, which collectively represent more than 450,000 Minnesotans. And it's a real pleasure to be here today and talk about our priorities this year. As I think you realize, every year we bring our members together, they nominate issues and select three or four issues that we really want to focus in on. And this question of safeguarding investments for Minnesota's future, which is what we're talking about today, is one of the four things that we're focusing on this year collectively as a community. MEP has been involved in this issue for the last 6 years easily. In 2004 was the first year as part of our collaborative agenda to work on the Clean Water Legacy Act, asking for at least $75 million a year to go into funding for a sustained program to clean up our lakes, rivers, and streams. We came back in 2004, came back in 2005. Some of you maybe remember a little fee thing we had a number of us were pushing, which was a tax on toilet or sewer hookups. And as we know, none of that flew. And then in 2006, 2007, 2007, 2008, now 2009, we've been working on what became known as the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. And that's really what I'd like to talk about today. Because after a sustained effort on both the habitat side, the art side, and also on the water side, we were able to bring that to the voters this past fall. And as you know, I won't tell it to you again. I'm sure you've heard it and said it a million times yourself. It was an overwhelming success with the public. And clearly the public has spoken and said that they want to support clean land, clean water, our lakes, rivers, and streams, land and habitat, parks, trails, as well as our cultural assets. MEP was very involved in that effort even during the campaign. Many of you may not realize that in addition to the Vote Yes campaign, there was kind of a shadow nonprofit campaign. And MEP headed up a group of five nonprofits who did a lot of the research, outreach, and education without doing Vote Yes, all in the non-lobbying mode, where we raised and spent $1 million last year on the constitutional amendment. So we're heavily invested in this. And I want to talk about two things today. Number one, a little bit about the amendment, and I know you've heard a lot of this, but from our perspective of why people voted yes and what it all means, and then how that relates to the budgeting process that you're dealing with today, which is probably what you're more interested in. But a couple of things that maybe you haven't heard as much about in regards to the amendment. Yes, it was an overwhelming success, but as best I know, our organization is the only organization that actually went into the field then and asked people why they voted for the constitutional amendment. There are many people speculating and claiming to know why, but we tested 700 people 2 weeks after the election and asked them specifically, how'd you vote on it? Why'd you vote on it? We asked them a lot of different questions. But what's interesting is the overwhelming response that we got was clean water. 42% of the people who voted yes said they voted to protect our lakes, rivers, and streams. And again, it is indeed our Minnesota heritage and part of our very core. The second highest reason for why people voted yes was a combination of all the other things: clean water, land, habitat, parks, arts, and culture. And that was at 29%. So even though water was part of that, you can see that water really overwhelmed the whole thing. And that was what really resonated with the public. The second point I want to make is that And again, I know you've heard this, but this is carried throughout the campaign. The need is grave. And the number one message that we led with in the campaign and still resonates with the public and is still overwhelmingly true is that our waters are terribly polluted. 40% that we test do not meet basic health standards, as you know. We have been looking at funding levels that are as low as they have been in the 30-year history of environmental funding. And we also are facing growth with as much of 1 million acres of natural areas being lost to new development over the next 20 years. So we have a lot, we have need, we have a message that resonates with the public, and the public said, go forth, take action. And the constitutional language is also clear. As you know, it says we need to protect our resources. And a real priority for our groups, in addition to the overall amendment, is the clean water funding and the clean water land and legacy implementation that we've been working on for a half a dozen years. And Paul and others will detail a little bit more about exactly what that means. The other point that I really want to make clear is that is kind of the substitution supplant issue, substitution supplement issue, I guess is the better way to say it. You know, we feel very clearly, very strongly, and our members do, that the Constitution needs to be upheld and needs to be followed very directly, and that these funds need to be used for the long term. And as much of a challenge as we have in addressing our budgets, it's important that these funds not be used as a substitute for a short-term fix. The public is very clear on that, and they feel strongly that they must not be used or rated for that purpose. These funds are really about protecting Minnesota's future for the long term, for next generation. I forgot my little green Protect Minnesota Futures button today. I meant to put it on, but that's really what these funds are intended for. The question is, what does that really mean in today's reality and in today's budget process? And I just want to make three general comments and then turn it over for the questions or over to Paul. Number one, as it relates to the general fund. That is where we focus a lot of the discussion, and that's where you have the biggest challenge in balancing a budget this year. We are deeply concerned about the governor's budget that disproportionately targets conservation environmental programs with cuts that are 10 times the overall reductions in general fund programs. If you look at the overall reduction in the governor's general fund budget, it's about 2.2%. If you look at the biennium to biennium number on the reduction of general fund dollars to environmental conservation numbers, it's 23%. That is not proportionate. That is not consistent with the Constitution. And we feel that that is something that should not stand. It does not follow the clear direction that Minnesota voters sent in November in passing the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. In fact, the governor's recommendations are on course to take us to the lowest percentage of state general fund dollars going to environmental conservation programs in the history of tracking these programs, which is like 30-year plus. So we were at one point, we were about 1%. The governor's budget in 2011 would take us down under 1% to 0.96%. In the current biennium, counting all funds, general fund dollars, we're about 1.2%. So the measure that we're going to use as we look at this is how are these programs treated in relation to the overall budget? And we understand that no one can be isolated from reductions, but as reductions are made, we feel it's only fair that these programs not be singled out for a deeper cut than the overall percentage. And not only is it fair, it's also in keeping with the clear constitutional language that was overwhelmingly adopted by the public in November. The second point is a little bit of a more positive point, and that's statutory funds. As you all understand way too well, our funding comes from a number of different sources, general fund being important and getting most of the attention, but the statutorily dedicated funds are also very important. When the budgets were adopted, 6 years ago, in the last, the last major budget crunch, virtually every dedicated fund that wasn't constitutionally protected was raided. If there's one that wasn't, I don't know what it is, but you know, it could be I missed something. But as best I know, everything was raided that wasn't constitutionally protected. I'm happy to say, generally, in the budget the governor put forward, the statutorily dedicated funds are kept in good shape. That includes the Environment and Natural Resources Fund with the Department of Natural Resources and the Environmental Fund that the PCA relies on. So that's very good, and we would ask the legislature to continue to support that recommendation. And the last of the three legs of the funding stool that I want to talk about is bonding. I realize this isn't a bonding session, but it's important to look at the major sources: general fund, dedicated funds, and special revenue funds, and then bonding. And there is a bonding bill moving through the legislature this year. It's not something that we're actively engaged in, but much like the general fund, for us, over time, the way we will track this is to look at what have we done historically over time. And over the last 10 years, we've averaged 22.2% of bonding commitments have been to environment conservation programs. As we look at this biennium, when your work is done in the 09 and the 10 session, we'll take that same measure, and it's our hope and expectation that the legislature will continue that traditional source of revenue, as the Constitution says, and keep our bonding level at about the same level. Understanding we're not making the pitch this year that we need to, this is a smaller kind of emergency-focused bonding bill, but overall for the two-year cycle, we will look at that, and it'll be very important in our consideration. We have three other people who'd like to testify. Madam Chair, I don't know if you'd like to do questions now or get the other comments, and we can have more of a dialogue.
We'll take some questions. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Morse, you brought up some great points, and maybe the other three testifiers are going to deal with this, but and I realize that you're talking about the governor's cuts. But what are you thinking about in terms of this money that's come in with the constitutional amendment, in terms of new ways to go or things that you think that need to be done over and above so we don't end up supplementing the current funding?
That some of you at this table, Senator Saxhog, Madam Chair, could address that. You've been sitting through the Outdoor Heritage Council recommendations, and that process has been pretty visible in public. Paul Austin is going to discuss in a little bit more detail the clean water legacy portion of the funding. And we really feel on the water side, that, as I said, we've been working on for 6 years as a coalition. That is the number that we brought to the table to include in the legislation, and that is the problem that drove the entire public dialogue. The 40% of our waters that don't meet basic health standards is the number one message that was used with the public and that resonated with the public, and the reason the public voted for this. And so we feel the clean water legacy is really critical.
Senator Saxhog.
Hey, well, I understand that, Senator Morse, but I realize 40% is the big bad boogeyman. But I mean, the question is, how are we going to use that money to take care of that? That's what I want to know. And is Mr. Aston going
to? I could start to go into detail, but he's kind of queued up for that. So let him take.
Let's turn to Mr. Austin.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Paul Austin. I'm the Advocacy Director with the Minnesota Center of Environmental Advocacy. I'm going to just take a moment and run through a very brief presentation of how we're thinking, and by we, it's spanning a bigger and bigger group as we go, how we're kind of thinking about what the Clean Water Legacy Act means, what addressing clean water in the state means. First of all, on the we front, it's MEP is a total, so it's the MCA and Clean Water Action and Conservation Minnesota and all the members of MEP. There's also a nice alignment with the G16, which is a real broad-ranging group that's been together for about 7 years that's made up of environmental groups, business groups, the chambers there, the state agencies are there, agriculture is there, both the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union, soil and watershed conservation districts, just a wide range of folks that have worked on this same issue for a long time. That's another piece of the we. And just to relate it directly back to the governor's budget, the governor's budget largely borrowed its proportions as it was looking at spending on specific programs from the Clean Water Council's recommendations. Well, the Clean Water Council's recommendations, the G16's thinking over time, MEP's thinking as a group now, are all in great alignment. So we can argue about dollars in places, but the general feel is shared across the playing field. And that's what I'll talk to and show you now. The first thing that we want to remind everybody is what we're really talking about doing in our vision of how you spend the clean water money. We're talking about implementing the Federal Clean Water Act. We're not talking about doing something brand new. This is the Clean Water Act from 1972. And there's a timeline coming up in here where we can show how we've worked through this as a state over the past 40, 50 years, depending on how you look at it. But the goals of the Clean Water Act are pretty straightforward. At the end of the day, the waters of the state are supposed to be fishable, swimmable, and drinkable. And that's a goal that we want to keep in front of everybody and keep reminding ourselves that's what we're aiming at the end of the day. So how do we get clean water? First of all, you have to do testing and assessment of the water. When Steve is talking about the fact that only 40% of the waters meet state water quality standards, he's talking about the waters that have been tested. Well, less than 15% of the lakes and less than 10% of the rivers have ever been tested. So starting out in about 2004, 2005, there has been a little bit of money that's been in the system to get this thing off the ground. The Pollution Control Agency is committed at this point in time to staying on a 10-year cycle to repeatedly test the waters of the state simply to see how we're doing. This is the checkup at the doctor's office.
Why don't you ask Alec or somebody else to do
that? After you do that, you figure out what you have to do. The name that you're going to hear us throw around because we only know how to use acronyms is TMDL. It stands for Total Maximum Daily Load. This is the diet plan for that body of water. And there's a need to put this cleanup plan together and figure out what limits have to be on what polluters in that watershed to make sure that that water meets standards. It's that straightforward. Next step, go to the point sources. These are the easiest to find sources. These are the pipes that empty out. Wastewater treatment plants are the classic example of these sources. In the hierarchy of addressing pollution, the Clean Water Act says this is the order you go in. It's a good order, and I'll show you later that we think it works. After you get done looking at point sources, or concurrently, if you're doing a really good job on your science, you also start looking at non-point sources. And this is where you get up on the land, maybe way away from the water, and start dealing with runoff over land, runoff through all kinds of different systems that we don't normally think of as being part of the hydrology of that process. And then the real beauty of this is you get to start it again. I'm an environmental toxicologist by training. I cut my teeth doing 96-hour toxicological assays in the back of a semi-trailer that was filled with lab gear. Science is not interesting. Science is redundant, repetitive work.
Don't say that. That's how you get. My son might hear you.
And you
I keep and, trying and, to get him.
And you collect data in little tidbits at a time. So even with this wonderful cycle that's up here, in the 25 years of the amendment, we're only talking about 2.5 testing cycles. That's how laborious science is when you're actually out there trying to get the work done. Let's talk about how long we've worked at this. In 1969, Congress debated the Clean Water Act after the Cuyahoga River burned again. That river started burning in the 1880s. It's been a long discussion. 72, Federal Clean Water Act passes, sets up that cycle we just started talking about. In 1986, there was a partial cleanup plan done for the lower part of the Minnesota River. There's been some lawsuits along the way. Maybe some of us have had something to do with some of those. There was a constitutional amendment that started to be talked about in the late 90s. In 2000 and 2001, the Minnesota Chamber and MCEA started kind of a conversation of a pre-G16 style coalition saying, we got a water problem in this state. We ought to keep talking about it. In 2002, 30 years after the Federal Clean Water Act passed, the first complete cleanup plan is done in this state. And then we get into the conversation that Steve was talking about. 2003, the Pollution Control Agency issues a report that says we need $80 to $100 million a year to clean up these problems and figure out what we're doing. 2004, 5, 6, the G16 is together. It's together to this day, working on this issue, proposing the Clean Water Legacy Act. 2005, there was some funding put into this pot. 2006, some more partial funding. Clean Water Legacy Act was enacted. In December of 2006, the governor appointed the Clean Water Council. Some more partial appropriations in 2007. 2008, constitutional amendment passes, the watershed mark. And 2009, these first sales tax revenues are here now in front of the legislature to talk about appropriating them. So it's been a long path to get to where we are today. But there's been a lot of consistency to how it's been approached. So how do you get to the final endpoint? You've already got it on the books. Clean Water Legacy Act is there. It sets up the purposes for money that would address clean water. Test and assess on a 10-year cycle. It's going to cost 12 to 15. This is not per year. This is actually per biennium. That's a typo on my part. Prepare TMDLs, $19 to $20 million a biennium. And then balance the rest of those dollars across the point and non-point source issues as they come in front of you. The PFA has a wonderful process to prioritize point source work. part of their priority listing is the need in that water body. We think that's fabulous. Bowser and the other agencies that work on the land are using similar things now. It's a beautiful way to prioritize where you go to the problems that you've identified from your testing and assessing in your cleanup planning. So who does it? Pollution Control Agency does the testing and assessment with help from DNR, MDA, local governments, and citizens. So when you look at the governor's budget, those pieces are there. We're happy about that. That's a good thing. Who does the TMDLs? Again, the PCA is in the lead with help from DNR, and there's a public participation component. When you look at the recommendations from the Clean Water Council, they talk about public participation. We think that is an important piece of the puzzle. When you talk about point source control, you're talking the cities, you're talking PFA, you're talking MPCA.
Excuse me, Mr.
Yes.
Mr. Assen. Senator Saxon.
Two slides back.
Yes. You can go.
We're talking per year.
I've got
it. There you go.
Yep.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, there's 24 or 25 years of this funding. How many of these are going to be?
How many of these do you need for each year?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. Let me do this. This is a different way to look at. Where'd it go?
That was good.
It was there a minute ago. Here it comes. No? Oh, I see. Never mind. A second. Let's see.
There you go.
I bet it jumps back to the front of the show.
Show it right there. You can see it.
Here we go. Bingo. Here we go. Oh, there it is.
There it is.
All right. This is another way to look at it. Like I said, there's a typo on that other slide. It wasn't per year. It was per biennium. This is the numbers on the left-hand side here are per year. And one way to think about this is a 25-year span. If you're going to do this water quality testing on a 10-year cycle, you're going to have to dedicate roughly $7 million through the life of this amendment to that process. If you're going to do this TMDL prep to match up with that testing, you're going to have to dedicate about $10, $11 million a year throughout the duration of this process. As you get down the slide, when you're looking at point source implementation, in this scenario, it's presuming you're going to have roughly $24 million a year headed toward point source cleanup in the early years, but that'll shrink over time. The amount that this shrinks is purely speculative. It may be faster, it may be slower, but the point is we do know we can find point sources and address them. We should then be able to take them off the ledger. If you look at the non-point source, there's a presumption that that work will grow over time. Again, the non-point source problem is at least as big, if not bigger, than the point source problem in the stream. And when you're trying to fix it, it's arguably a bigger problem because it's more diffuse. So over time, would there be more effort going into that? We certainly think so. Drinking water protection, it's in the Constitution. It's part of this funding. This is just extending, theoretically, the kind of current level proposal. That may change over time as we understand groundwater sustainability issues better. And then there's an education, research, and tools piece of this proposal that is part of the Clean Water Council's recommendations. That's an important piece of money to have out there. When you hear people talking about things like LIDAR and these other tools that we could develop, it's awfully nice to have some education and research money available in a given year to do some of that work. So this is more of a 25-year vision of how you could spend the money.
Mr. Austin, do you consider that the whole groundwater piece falls only under the drinking water protection?
Madam Chair, definitely not. I mean, when you start talking, if you simply are even talking about drinking water protection, you're interested in surface water and groundwater. Clearly, point sources affect surface water quality, potentially for some of the bigger metropolitan areas that pull surface water. That's got to be part of that conversation. And similarly, on the non-point source side, wellhead protection and groundwater infiltration are big pieces of that equation. So in my mind, if you can have a project that does both, wonderful. And when Bowser's scoring proposals that are in front of them for non-point source work, that should be one of the criteria in consideration.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Austin, I notice on your top bar there you talk about water quality testing. Is there anywhere in your plan where you deal with water quantity? In some of the readings I've been doing in the last couple of weeks, I'm getting a growing understanding that water quantity, especially groundwater, will affect surface water, streams, and swimmability and habitat. Where does that fit into your plan?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, in the plan as it sits here, that water quality testing is really aimed at the surface water quality testing needed for the Clean Water Act implementation. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't interconnections. For example, if there's a pesticide issue in a stream that's picked up in the surface water quality testing and it's coming from some sort of groundwater contamination source, then it could come into play as you're looking at the cleanup plans. But there's not really a water quantity component to the Federal Clean Water Act implementation.
Do you think there should
be?
Madam Chair, Senator, clearly drinking water protection and groundwater quantity protection are a huge issue. The need of 80 to 100 million that this debate was held around when we started talking about the constitutional amendment was really the need based on that surface, addressing the surface water quality. I think we'd have to have a much longer conversation about the actual amount of money needed to do a complete drinking and groundwater protection plan for the state, and I can't give you a number at this point in time.
Well, okay, Senator Rubble, you then I got something
just
to say.
Just a simple follow-up. So we do know that within the next 10 to 15 years we'll have a million more people living here, and water quantity is going to be an issue.
Well,
there's no question.
And Mr. Austin, I would say that our job as statewide policymakers is to have that comprehensive statewide plan that deals with all of those aspects of water and not just to focus on the Clean Water Legacy Act, even though I agree with you, it's the centerpiece. It's the main, you know, it's the big kahuna, but it's not the only game in town. And I just have to say I've been hearing a lot of people tell me what the amendment was passed for and what the intent was. I've been hearing that a lot from a lot of people, and they all have, each person you ask has a different opinion about what that intent was of the voters. So I just kind of want to mention that for the record. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And back to our the graph that you have right there, and again, supplementing versus supplanting. What are we doing right now in relationship to that? Anything or a part of that? Or
Madam Chair, Senator, there's a couple levels to look at that question. Level number one, if you look at the governor's recs, there are at least some items in the governor's recs that MCEA would point at and say, that used to be funded out of the base budget of the agency, so it doesn't feel like it should be over here. It feels like a clear, you know, substitution. A good example is the water quality database that's in the governor's recs. Great thing to do, very important thing to do, but every past iteration and upgrade on that data system has been done with the general fund dollars that that agency gets. So, you know, when you're looking at and talking about specific agencies and specific items, I think there are some things that we would encourage you to look at and ask some questions about. Drinking water work, extraordinarily important, making sure the balance within the Department of Health on older versus new to make sure that the new money truly supplements the existing program, I think is the key. When you look at the clean water money alone, the debate will really hinge on how you think about quote-unquote one-time monies in past budgets. When we talk about 1.23% of the state's general fund as a base for where we think that's the floor and this money supplements on top of that, we view that one-time money and the biennial money all in the same coffer. And we can make an argument that all budgetary money is one-time money. It's just a matter of whether you think it lasts for 2 years or not. So that's where it gets much grayer. I think asking about what supplements, what's an improvement on top of what had previously been done, is the first step in taking a look at that constitutional test.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Austin, you're answering a question I had written down here, so I appreciate your jumping ahead. Are you suggesting then that besides the Clean Water Legacy money, there should be a 3% in the governor's recs for the environment out of the general fund, that there's those two funds at least?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, that is, that's the position that we've staked out is on the environmental side of the equation. It goes back to this notion that state was the general fund appropriations for environmental purposes in the last biennium was 1.23%, and that's what the people of the state voted to add to with the constitutional amendment.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morse, if I could just chime in on that. If you look on the chart on page 9, it shows the recent funding history of environment conservation programs. And yes, our position is that line ought to stay flat. This is a percentage of state general fund dollars. As Paul said, it's 1.22, 1.23%.
Senator Rummel.
And you argued earlier, and quite coherently, frankly, that overall the governor's cuts are around 2%, but to environment it's 23%. Would you argue that if, because the Senate has taken a position that we're going to do proportional cuts, so if we do a 7% cut, would you, how would you
take a crack at that? We think proportional reductions for our programs in light of the constitutional provisions that citizens have enacted for environmental conservation programs make sense and are the way to go. That we ought to be treated the same as the general reductions in general fund programs.
All right, Mr. Austin, were you done with your PowerPoint?
Madam Chair, I'm done enough.
Done enough, we may have more questions for you, so don't go anywhere.
I'd be happy to try to answer them.
And
pass it over to you.
Members, I'm tempted to editorialize a tiny bit more, and then we're going to vote on Senator Vickerman's bill, if you'll just allow us for a moment here. And I just to follow up on this whole what was the voter's intent issue, I know Senator Morse, you've been quoted recently as talking about the polling data. And I think the one thing that we do know is that it was the clean water concern that passed this amendment. And I think that is important to remember. And I've heard it said recently by one unnamed media source, or actually several, that the reason the voters passed this amendment, it was a referendum on the fact that the legislatures failed to do our job. And I thought, boy, that's someone who sees the glass half empty. A pessimist, a real cynical view of the world. And I would look at it in a much more positive light. Senator Vickerman, we do have a quorum present, and we should move your bill.
Well, Madam Chair, then I will move that Senate file number 35 be recommended to pass and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, and so we'll lay it on the table
right.
Then. All right. On that motion, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no? Very good. Motion prevails. All right, let's continue. Mr. Gerber, are you next?
Well, Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name's Darrell Gerber, D-A-R-R-E-L-L, and I'm with Clean Water Action. I'm the water program coordinator there. And Clean Water Action actually is really interesting to see the timeline that Paul put up there, because if you look back in 1972 with the passage of the Clean Water Act, that was the same time that Clean Water Action got started nationally. It actually formed around the addressing the problems of the Clean Water Act, and you know, it's really nice to have one of your first victories as an organization, the passage of really one of our really bedrock environmental regulations in the country. Right now, we're a national organization, and we have a Minnesota office in Minneapolis. Nationally, we have about 1.5 million members. In Minnesota, we have right now 134,000 members in this state. And one of the things that you know, I wanted to maybe throw a little bit out there more on this question of what did people vote on the amendment about. It's a little bit of a less scientific approach that we took, but I wanted to give the committee a collection of letters that we got. We actually sent out to our members and just an open-ended question and asked them, why did you vote for the amendment? And we got over 200 responses, and I'd like to submit those to the committee, and they're actually listed as much information as we have about who they are. You know, they allowed us to submit their letters to them, and But I think one of the key things there is that many of these people, we didn't prompt them, we didn't direct them anywhere, but it was amazing to see how well they actually stayed on exactly what we had been saying for quite a while. One of the key things, I'd like to read one off that actually gets to the supplant supplement question. And this person said, I voted for the amendment as adding above and beyond to current spending. If the budget requires making cuts in these areas, that is understandable, but do so only proportionately to cuts in other areas, and do not consider the dollars generated by this portion of the sales tax as a mean of offsetting the cost of things that historically have been in the budget. And then there's a lot of things, responses too, of just what do they value, and I think it really echoes what Steve had found in the polling, is that it is the water, it is the heritage that they see in our water resources as an important part of that. So I'd like to leave this for the committee to look over. And one of the things, too, I think is looking at that history is, you know, when we're looking at a new source of funding like this is, you know, looking for the plans. And I know that there's been a lot of talk about, is there a plan out there? You know, what's kind of the direction for this? And, you know, I think Paul said it well, that we start with the Clean Water Act. You know, that's the basic plan that's been in place for over 35 years now. We have the Clean Water Legacy Act. We had the analysis that the G16 put together that was really looking at what the need is. And then we have the Clean Water Council's recommendations, which we've made available to the committee here, a copy of their recommendations. And really all along the line, it's still identifying the same need, the same proportionate distribution of the money. And I think it's important to recognize, of course, that this is not sufficient for the need, what we're talking about here. Is that we are way behind on meeting the drinkable, fishable, swimmable standards, and we have a long ways to go, but we also know where to start. I think Paul pointed out well in this graph in that the point source is something that is pretty well known. That's the wastewater treatment plants. That is, you know, a number of these other things. They're also some of the pretty expensive things to deal with, but we can start up with those right now and keep moving. It's something that the federal government has actually been spending money on through this Clean Water State Revolving Fund. And, you know, they recognize this as an important source, and luckily we got some more money in that coming to the state in the stimulus package. And I think we can expect some more of that coming down the road, an increase in that direction as well from the federal government to hopefully meet the amount of need that is out there without putting all of it on the backs of the state to cover. I think that's, I'll kind of close off there, just kind of stand open for questions or pass on.
All right, question, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have more of a general question, and the goal of fishable, swimmable, drinkable waters, are waters fishable, drinkable, swimmable?
Madam Chair and members, that's kind of where this question that was mentioned about the percentage of the waters that have been tested that are impaired, it deals exactly with that. So 40% of the waters that have been tested are not fishable, swimmable, or drinkable.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Hand.
And so you're, the criteria for fishable, swimmable, drinkable is impairment. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, within the Clean Water Act, it actually puts in place that impairment is determined kind of through a set of criteria that's ultimately based on what is the use for that water. And it's kind of hard to say a blanket statement, but each one of them has a kind of a criteria that's laid out, and they do the testing, and their goal, their levels. For some of them, they are above the acceptable level for nutrients. Some of them are above the acceptable levels for mercury. Some of them are above it for road salt. It kind of varies from each to each, and the standards are different, but they're all based on that kind of that basic goal. What is the acceptable level to be fishable, swimmable, and drinkable?
And
Paul may actually be able to add some more.
Okay. And Madam Chair, just to kind of had a couple of questions here that relate, but have we made progress on this goal? In other words, if you go back to 1972 when or 69 maybe, or whenever you pick a point, and where we are today, and we've made some investment, have we made progress? How much? How would you answer that?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I'd like to take that. Having worked at the end of the pipe for a while at the start of my career, I personally think the Clean Water Act is the way all environmental regulatory acts should be structured. It set out with high-level goals, fishable, swimmable, drinkable, gave the states a directive and a process to take those words and translate them into numbers based on nutrients or toxics or suspended solids in a water itself, charge them with on a three-year revolving basis, going through and updating their standards so it reflects the best that science can bring to bear on how much nickel is okay to have in a body of water. And it might be for you to drink, it might be for contaminating fish, or it might be for killing the aquatic plants that live in that body of water. So whichever of those is the lowest trigger, it triggers that standard. So this process has been going on, these triennial rule reviews have been going on, the science has been collected, and then the Clean Water Act said, but we're not going to sit and wait 20 years to figure out how much nickel should be in that stream. We know we've got a burning river right now. So we're going to tell you that at the minimum, on your sewage treatment plants, so you have to start out with the first level of treatment, and everyone's got to go put that in no matter what. And for those rivers and streams that, as we start to test, we know they're more polluted, you've got to go to the second level no matter what. So getting everybody up to quote-unquote secondary treatment is a piece of this puzzle. And then after that, you still have to go out there and test and assess that river. And if you're not making it, those point sources have to think about doing even more. That's been an enormously successful program. There used to be floating mats of sewage above the Hastings Dam. You don't see that anymore. I saw people putting their boats in that river last weekend to go fishing. So there have been tremendous success stories. Lake Minnetonka used to be just polluted to no end because every community dumped all their sewage into Lake Minnetonka. Those are all long gone. So there have been huge success stories, but we still have fish consumption advisories. We've had a big push in this state to address mercury. Mercury fish tissue levels were going down until the last couple of years. They're going back up because of all the coal being burned across this country and internationally. So great success stories, but we're not done yet.
And Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I guess that what I'm trying to get a feel for is whether we're making progress toward this goal and how close we're getting. And part of that is related to, I guess, if you've got a big mess, which arguably we had in the early 70s or whenever the pick a day, and you begin to address that, and you get a fairly large return for your investment that you put in, you see, maybe you get 90% of the problem taken care of in the first 10 years. And then you have more costly and difficult things to do to close the gap to get it to zero, if that's the goal, if that's even possible. And so at some point you have to ask the question of what is the cost you're getting for the return. And I'm just wondering, have you made any attempt to calculate where we are on that? Are we approaching that point? Have we not gotten to it yet? When do we get there? How do we know when we get there? Because I'll be honest with you, I don't know that you can make the goal of clean water the highest priority for the state. Now, maybe you would, but I don't know that I would. And there are other priorities that we have as well. And you're talking about in terms of the budget. Some of us think education is a pretty high priority. Some of us think health care is. Some of us think other things are. And so that's what I'm trying to understand, is where are we in this and how close we are, and what is the level of commitment that you think we need to continue to make going forward? And I know it's kind of a big question, but whatever you can do with it.
Mr. Austin.
Madam Chair, Senator, two things. One is, you're correct. We think clean water is an extraordinarily high priority. And 1.6 million Minnesotans agreed with us last November 4th. So that is all we're talking about with this piece of this conversation right now is that piece of the constitutional funding that is dedicated to clean water. Could we come back and say, well, this is nice, but we could use $250 million a year? You bet. But we're not here to have that conversation today unless Senator Bach has a new tax source that he hasn't told us about yet. But in terms of that point of the tipping point on investment, quantitatively, that's hard to lay up. I can tell you qualitatively where we are. The point sources, particularly the large wastewater treatment plants in this state, have moved well down their chain of putting on treatment at high expense, at great expense. The Metro plant or the Pig's Eye plant is a couple billion-dollar facility down here at the end of the road, down here in Shepherd Road, and that services the area from everywhere that you think of as Metro, all the way north to Forest Lake, all the way west out to the Plymouth area. I mean, it's a huge undertaking. That is probably at its point of diminishing return. And that is why in this graphic you see this swing toward non-point source controls. The point sources have done a lot of the work. There's a little more work to do there. But that balance is going to tip in the very near future. Is it 5 years or 10 years? I don't know the answer to that question yet. We'd have to sit down with PFA and the cities to try to guess at that. But one of the reasons the G16 has always talked about this point source starting bigger and getting smaller is because everybody who's in this game realizes we're at that point where investments in point sources will yield a smaller return than an investment in non-point sources. The other thing that I think is important to point out, the governor's budget has a much lighter first year in the biennial budget that they proposed. I would sit here, and I think everyone at the table would say, no, this money is dedicated. Put it on the ground. Put it to work for two reasons. One is we want clean water. The other is every one of these dollars out there creates a job. And two words, green jobs. This is about as green as it gets, or as blue as it gets, if you want to go there.
Senator Sachs-Hogg, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that Senator Hamm brings up a good point here that, you know, we kind of got to judge. We've got to find a baseline, and I'm not exactly clear where that baseline is, but I think looking at the half-full portion, you know, I think that we've made some remarkable strides already in the history of this state. I'm not one that's going to argue with the graph that you have there, but you use the word diminishing return, and particularly there's probably some things up there that we may or may not, but it's possible we could see some diminishing return and we have some room for to do some other things. The other thing that I bring up is that one of the other parts of this amendment was habitat, and there's virtually no part of that whole habitat amendment that doesn't deal with non-point source water. So, you know, you've virtually got twice as much money going to water.
That's true. And we'll be seeing that. I mean, the package that was approved by the council has lots and lots of acres of wetland protection in it and acquisition of wetlands in particular. And so lots and lots of miles along water will be protected. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one thing that we are going to need from you with regards to some of the comments that Senator Hand makes, which I think are important today since we're fighting for resources, and some of us think that this is very important, and so we need to make a case for you, but for all of us, for our children, and for our environment, is really this issue, and I'm glad you mentioned Minnetonka and the progress, Lake Minnetonka and the progress we've made. But I think that what is unclear, at least to me, is to what extent we really measure progress, kind of take a look at the investment we make, and then we get to a point where we go backwards. We made a lot of progress in Lake Minnetonka, And now we're finding that we have lots of problems because of whatever we are doing with, you know, in terms of nutrients that we apply, in terms of invasive species. And so I think that we're going to need help in terms of defining, you know, restrictions so that we can maintain the progress and not go back and have to invest again. And I think that's an important point because we're not going to have, you know, enough resources to go back to make the investment that we needed to make in Minnetonka 30 years ago. So I hope that we're working together to define what that is and how do we bring to the legislature proposals that really look at perhaps incentives or restrictions that we can put in place to sustain and maintain the progress we've made with water, because if not, we're never going to get there.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Gerber.
And Senator, I think that's a really important point because as time goes on, the challenges do change. You know, it changes from, you know, as the use of the land changes, and it's important to keep monitoring that. And, you know, I can say for sure that the groups up here at the table will continue to work on that. But there's also, you know, over the life of this amendment money, there is the continuous monitoring and oversight role that the Clean Water Council plays to look at this, you know, look at the each year, put out a report. There's also the role that we all play, and then plus with the testing and monitoring, as Paul mentioned, the 10-year cycle, that's new. That we haven't been doing that. And with the proposal from the Pollution Control Agency to kind of change the way that they do this testing and monitoring so that it is a 10-year cycle, it's actually a very important step to actually go back and test the waters again and make sure that we're improving and have maintained at least the water quality where there is good water quality still.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Torres-Ray. And I think Mr. Aston explained this to me also. Part of the TMDL process is not only to identify the impairments, but when we identify the clean waters, the ones that are, it costs us a lot less money to keep them clean. So part of the plan is how to preserve the waters that are clean, as well as to restore the waters that are spoiled. So that's built right into the TMDL, I believe. Right?
Does that come under the non-point source and the point source implementation? That's part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Very good. All right. Let's let Mr. Tuma testify.
Yeah, Madam Chair, for the record, I am not Cheryl Appledorn. I am here on her behalf. We were hoping that she could make it. She was in transit yesterday, and so we just kind of try to make a stab at hopefully this portion of her schedule is open, but it is not. And so my name is John Tuma. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership and Conservation Minnesota. And it's Conservation Minnesota since 2002 has put together this document. It's by the numbers. Cheryl Appledorn is the brains behind that. She has been working on this for those last 7 years, putting together really an oversight, not only the governor's budget, but the budgets that the legislature has put together. This is at a very high level, very much of a macro viewpoint of kind of where the budgets are and looking at the numbers so we can make a comparison how the conservation, environment, clean water budgets are doing. Steve really did walk through some of the numbers, so I'm not going to go over them again. But just to point out, since 1976, if the governor's budget were put into place, that would be a modern all-time low, down to 0.96% of the state general fund budget. Where on average we've been riding at well above that, and for a number of years, about a decade in the past, we've only almost been 2% of the state's budget, and so that would be a significant drop. Just so you can kind of get an idea of how that relates to the constitutional amendment, I always do this when I talk to people. If you look at the handout that Steve passed around, our Protect Minnesota Future, and you look on page 9, there's the graph kind of the macro look at conservation environment funding. And we used to, back prior to 2002, make up almost 2% of the state's general fund budget. That's not a lot. Okay, we're a small part of this whole picture, okay? And you see it dropped off quite a bit. Well, if you throw in and just take an average of that decade back there and run that across to where we are now, and if you add in the dedicated funding money, that the funding money that was just passed by the voters, it gets us back to about that average of where we were a decade ago. And so as you look at this new money, and we're the only ones getting new money for these activities, recognize that we're probably only getting back to some of the historic levels that we were at prior to 2002. And so if you have any questions regarding the By the Numbers document, feel free to contact Conservation Minnesota, contact myself, or we'll get you hooked up to Cheryl Appledorn, who understands the numbers. If you didn't get one of these reports, you can go online at minnesotaconservation.org and download it or look at it from there. And again, we appreciate your time. This is just a resource that we provide to our members and to you to kind of get a good macro picture of where the budgets have been over the number of years. We appreciate the hard work that you, Madam Chair, and the rest of these members have put in over the years to protect and to enhance conservation funding in some pretty tough times. And so thank you for your hard work, and we look forward to working with you again this year, trying to find where we can invest sensibly some of those dollars that the voters so generously gave us this last year. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tuma. Any other questions for the panel that's up there? Mr. Gerber?
Madam Chair, I actually wanted to take a chance to get jump back to something that Senator Hahn asked previously about, kind of as an economic development, you know, kind of looking in tough economic times and priorities. There's one thing that I wanted to mention out is actually that the Federal Clean Water Act requires that no permits be issued, let me see if I get this right, on any project that causes or contributes to a known impairment, which means that until we get these impairments cleaned up, it does restrict the amount of economic development due in those 40% that are impaired now. The other part of this, too, and I actually wish I brought this report, another part of my work, I work on Great Lakes issues, and a national coalition that we're a part of called Healing Our Waters commissioned a report to actually look at what is the economic return on investment of restoring water, the Great Lakes. And this was actually a very conservative estimate. It was done by the Brookings Institute. And, you know, looking at the economics modeling they did, it's pretty conservative. And they came up with it over 2-to-1 return on investment in economic development, primarily through property values increases.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, thank you. And thanks for the comment, Mr. Gerber. You raised a point, though, and I wanted to just follow up with you. You mentioned that there was a requirement that prevented any development unless an impairment has been cleaned. And I just wonder if you think that is a wise policy. And the reason I ask that is I know we've had, I think it was in our Agriculture Committee, it was last year perhaps, some debate about some things that were going on that were, at least many felt, good things that were not being permitted to be done because of this very issue. So I just want your perspective. Do you think that that's a wise policy to say no development until an impairment reaches a certain point, and is that a wise policy?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Gerber.
Senator, what it actually refers to are permits, which are the pollution discharge permits. So it doesn't refer to the other activities. So it really only refers to the permits that are in the discharge into those impaired waters. Now, the reason for that is partly because until you actually know what the sources are, all of those, is the idea is until that TMDL plan is created, that you don't start adding more to it. So basically, avoid getting into this never-ending loop where you don't know where you are, but you keep doing more of it, and then you don't figure it all out, and then you have to do it all again because the picture changed since you started.
I would look at it even in a simpler way, that basically it's just saying we've got a cap on pollution in these water bodies, and you just can't add to them. And that's what I think we should say. because once there's a certain amount of pollution, we need our state regulation does need to kick in and say no more. You got to figure out how to reduce it before you add more to it. And that's how I understand the law, and I think that is good policy, and I think that's what the public would expect from us. Senator Frederickson. Well,
Madam Chair, I want to comment on this issue, too. I think what the Federal Clean Water Act and the EPA says is that if there's going to be economic development in a community and that increased discharge to a water body and that water body is impaired, they can refuse to issue that permit until there has been an assessment and a TMDL developed. It doesn't say that you have to completely correct the impairment. It just says that the EPA has to approve the TMDL before development can continue. And we did have at least one situation at Annandale Maple Lake a few years ago where economic development was stalled, and it got to be quite controversial, ended up Minnesota Supreme Court, and there was some trading allowed that allowed the project to go ahead. But the issue is that the assessment has to be done and a TMDL developed, and then you have 10 years to work on implementing that TMDL before there's another assessment to see if you've made progress.
So the way that I described it was actually a little stricter than it actually works, because there is a little bit of a window there to get it done. Mm-hmm. But the concept is let's not add to this amount over time. So I appreciate that. Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Tumo a question about this chart, because I've seen other organizations lobbying for more money around here that uses the same type of chart, namely the K-12 education system often lobbies using these percentages, which makes it look like things are really bad. But I'm wondering if you took this chart and translated it into actual dollars spent and adjusted it for inflation, what it would look like. And I don't remember the size of the state budget in 1991, but I know it was substantially smaller than 2009. So if you take 2.5 or a little over 2% of the 91 budget and compare it with the 1.25% of the 2009 budget, what does it come out to in terms of dollars adjusted for inflation?
Senator Dill, I guess it's in the attachment D in the back of this by the numbers report.
Yeah.
There's a list of all the actual dollar amounts. If that's your comprehensive answer, yeah, we should let that answer that. But it's towards the back of this report.
And that's it's a good point. And you also have to take Madam Chair and Senator Dill into account, too, that we also have a lot of fees and other sources of funds, too. And so when you look at kind of the growth from 2002 through 2009, there has been growth in the overall amount of dollars that are available, both one-time money, fees, and everything that are there. So there is that is true. But as a percent of the overall, it's been relatively flat.
So the numbers are do rise on a consistent basis, but I think the point of this graph is they're rising more slowly than other parts of the budget, correct?
That's correct. I mean, if you look at a percent, I mean, from 2002, we were at 2.66. It dropped down to 2.15 for a period of time, and then through your efforts, one-time money, other things, you've got it back up to 2.32 of all funds that are out there. So, frankly, that means businesses, people who fish, get fish license, folks like that that are paying more out of their pocket to dedicate those sources to the money. Again, the general fund commitment to that has declined significantly over that period of time. We've kind of backfilled in a lot of the activities with funds that are dedicated.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
If I could on that, just on the general fund side, because I think maybe, Senator Dill, that was part of your question. In 2001, we had over $285 million in general fund appropriations. In the governor's budget, it'll be $161. So even if you look at it in terms of, that's non-inflation adjusted dollars. Mm. So it's actually a bigger impact than that, but it's 285 down to 161 in terms of general fund. So we're pushing the $300 million level, and now it's almost half that.
That's the high point.
More than half that, but nearly half cut.
Since then, we've moved things to other funds.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Senator Tory Sray.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but I cannot resist this comment because Senator Dale has made an observation that I was thinking about, and that is that every time I see these charts, whether they come from education or healthcare and now the environment, I can't help but to notice the year in which these bars actually go down, and must say that they coincide with this administration when this administration took over. So when we think about lobbying for money, I compare these statistics and I see these bars. In these few years, we have had a significant decline for all revenues in all budgets. So this is not the exception.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I would observe when I look at that chart, maybe I look at taxes too much, but I would observe they more closely coincide with the significant tax reductions we made in 99 and in 2000 and in 2001 when the economy was really moving along kind of at its pinnacle, and the legislature spent all the money. And frankly, Governor Plenty wasn't the governor. We overspent. We cut taxes too much, and the economy didn't hold up, and now we don't have enough money to hold anything, even at inflationary levels anymore. And it's because of decisions that were made. Well, when I got here in 95, we did a round of, you remember when you went to get your income tax filed, if you brought in your property tax statement, Senator Morse will remember this, brought in your property tax statement, you got a 20% rebate of your property taxes. That's how we started it off the first year I was here in 95. And then when Speaker Svigum took control to his credit, he realized that nobody realized that the legislature gave them that rebate. So we actually spent about $1.4 million to send out checks. So people realized that the legislature was really sending them money back. And then along came the sales tax rebates, the Jesse checks, and the school takeover and two rounds of income tax cuts. So I think the problem we have more closely coincides with all the tax reductions that were made when the economy was really humming along. And now we've found out that, you know, starting in 2003, that we've had constant deficits, that the state is out of financial balance. And some of that needs to be revisited if we're ever going to address people's priorities. And Senator Torres Ray, I don't mean to not blame the governor, but there's a lot more going on here than Governor Plenty.
Well, let's and be clear on that. Senator Bach, some of us didn't vote for those changes back then either, so there's plenty of blame to go around. And it's bipartisan blame, mm-hmm. in part, mm-hmm. because we made some bad decisions as legislators, but certainly as the governor as well. Senator Frederickson.
Well, Madam Chair, I want to...
But some of us didn't vote for support those. In the first place.
I wanted to make a comment about Governor Plenty's first budget, mm-hmm. where I think Senator Torres Ray observed that there was funding going down. Keep in mind we had something called an attack on this country on September 11th of year 2000. And I'm sure Governor Plenty would rather have not come into office facing a $4 billion deficit because of a national recession or a decline in the national economy. I'm sure the governor would much rather have come in at a stable time or even with a small increase in revenue because of existing tax rates. We're all caught in the national economy also.
Look what you've started.
I was going to say, Madam Chair, the Senator's idea. But we're hungry for this conversation, at least I am. I'm hoping, though, that we reflect on this and realize, Senator Beck, and enlist me, please, to help you turn this around, because we must. And I think that my intent is not to blame, but really to look at what is happening. And I am ready to turn the state around and do whatever it takes in terms of creating revenue and making the right decisions. I know it's not going to be easy, but I think that these charts are quite telling, and we're paying, you know, a high price and the consequences for not making those decisions, whether they were directives from the governor's office or our own decisions. But we need to turn this around, and I think that you know, the statistics are very clear.
Well, and I would say that talking about the voters' intent, that that was the voters' intent, that we need to turn this around. And so they sort of led the way in November on Election Day, and so we need to carry that mantle forward. Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to say to Senator Torres-Ray, I'm counting on you as one of those 34 votes on the Senate floor. So, I'm not 234 yet, but I just wanted to let you know you're one of 34. So.
All right. Well, we've got the tax bill figured out and the clean water bill. We want to thank you so much
you
for all
much.
Of your ideas and your advocacy. It's really
even
great. And we're going to need your help as we
that.
Move forward in putting this bill together. Thank you. I see a couple members of the G16 back there. You want to add anything? Any comments? Are you agreeing with everything that's been said?
I know you're better.
You don't have to, but might as well. If you're there, you're welcome to speak. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Robertson, this is unscripted. So,
Madam Chair, members, Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. Yes, unscripted. We were not intending to get up, but the discussion went into a area that's near and dear to my work that I've done for the last 5 years, which is looking at how we're going to deal with the federal requirements to deal with impaired waters. My cities deal with this daily, in that if we cannot build wastewater plants, we can't have the growth. We can't have the businesses come in. We can't have the new housing starts we're all hoping will kick back in over the next year or two. And the requirement is very simple. If the wastewater, either an expansion of an existing or a new wastewater facility, would cause or contribute to a known impairment, the permit can't come out unless that new pollutant load is within an approved federal pollutant load for that water. So the choices are you don't expand, you don't build, or you come up with very expensive treat to zero mechanisms to allow you to keep your pollutant load the same while you're drastically expanding the amount of waste coming out of the facility or being treated by the facility. So that's where the economy of scale comes in, is if we don't have a plan that gets these TMDLs done and approved by the federal government and then pays for the infrastructure we need to get up to that level of treatment, we're going to really see very expensive economic development impacts that my cities just can't afford to deal with on their own. So I thank you for your question. It was a very good question.
All right. Thank you for that perspective, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Robertson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mike Robertson, representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. For the last 7 years as part of the G16, where we have remained united, and we remain united in supporting the Clean Water Council recommendations. I agree totally with what Craig just said about the economic impacts. We need to work together to make sure we can accomplish these objectives to allow for economic development. Sometime a little bit later this year, we're going to be seeing a draft of the Lake Pepin TMDL, which will be the largest TMDL in the state, covering 55% of the land area. Dealing with the issue of phosphorus, and it's a huge watershed, and it's going to affect a large part of our economy, and that's the reason why we need to get these things done, why we need the resources included in the recommendations, and why we ask you for your support on those recommendations.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thanks so much. We also have Mr. Harnack. And while he's coming up, I'll just explain that Jeff Broberg wanted to testify. He had a scheduling conflict and at the last minute wasn't able to be here. And his concern that he wanted to talk about was relating to the merger of ecological resources or services. Which one is it called now? They keep changing names. Ecological resources and the water program at the DNR. So we can ask him to come another day, or I'll submit a letter on that. We also have a letter submitted from Stearns County from Mr. Wookin, who we've heard from on a previous occasion. So I ask members to take a look at that. And the last witness we have on our agenda is Mr. Harnack. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ron Harnack. I'm with the Red River Watershed Management Board, project coordinator. And I would just like to echo the comments of these previous speakers believe that I asked him to leave that graphic up there because I think as we move forward, I think the non-point issues are going to really be the critical ones if we're going to really improve our water quality across the state. And there are significant partners in this. The watershed districts, local units of government are key partners in solving these non-point issues. We certainly support moving forward with the recommendations that G16 has made. Two other things I'd like to speak to. The governor's recommendation does reduce funding to DNR Division of Waters for the Red River Mediation Work Group in the Red River Valley by $70,000 a year. The primary purpose of that initially was for each one of the watersheds to update their watershed plans consistent with the mediation agreement, which had a focus on flood damage reduction, but also had a component of natural resources enhancement, albeit the first round of updates had more emphasis on flood damage reduction than it did on natural resources enhancement, because that's been the major economic issue in the valley over the years, flooding, and will certainly probably be a significant issue again this year with the National Weather Service last Friday indicating that we can expect major flooding across the Red River Valley, in some cases approaching what we've seen in 1997, which was the flood of record. That said, we do not oppose that reduction at this point in time. We feel that everybody's got to tighten their belt and take reductions somewhere along the line. We do feel we have higher priorities within the budget of DNR, Division of Waters, and that being the funding that they already have in their base for Farmstead Ring Dike grants, as well as minimal general fund that's in there for flood damage reduction, a general fund component that helps support the bonding elements of it. It's kind of the precursor, the planning components that are there. So we certainly have a higher priority in that arena. We also look, as we move to the second round or the next 10 years of watershed plan updates, not only in the valley, but I think on a statewide basis, we look at opportunities of working through the Clean Water Legacy Framework. Because the next generation of watershed plans are going to give much more emphasis to water quality. We can't be everything to everybody in the state. And I think the setting of priorities must be set as much at the local level as it is at the state level. And I think working in partnership with state agencies and local governments, watersheds can do an excellent job of setting the priorities for what the needs are locally and then moving forward with addressing those specific priority needs over a 10-year basis. We match a lot of the funds that you're looking at giving out here through the watershed efforts and through the local units of government, and I think it's fair to give them a share in that priority setting long term. We also see these next generation plans having water quality capital improvement components, which will be significant in also addressing particularly the non-point issues for water quality. A second area that we have a concern with in the governor's reduction is a $100,000 reduction to Bowser's budget for the Red River Basin Commission. The Red River Basin Commission is an international commission representing the province of Manitoba, North Dakota, Minnesota, and South Dakota, as well as representatives from cities and watersheds from those states and provincial governments. The purpose of this organization is to try to address the flood damage reduction, water quality issues between East and West water law. And that is a significant difference. North Dakota and South Dakota operate in a prior appropriation. First come, first served. Minnesota and Manitoba operate on a reasonable use doctrine where everybody's got equal right and access to the utilization of that water. Trying to bring everybody to a common ground of public policy that ultimately we can bring back to our individual states to modify our existing state water policy so that we can accommodate one standard for the Red River Basin is a real challenge. It also goes to the heart of water quality. Lake Winnipeg has its own dead zone. The governors and the premier a couple years ago signed an agreement to reduce pollution loading at the U.S.-Canadian border. The Basin Commission is trying to work towards finding the common ground and achieving those reductions that would address the issues in Lake Winnipeg. We believe that $100,000 is very critical. It matches $100,000 from Manitoba, from North Dakota, from South Dakota, as well as an equal match from each of the local water management organizations in those respective areas. We feel that this puts the organization at risk, and certainly the commitment to a coordinated basin effort in water quality at risk as well. And we would ask your serious consideration of maintaining the $100,000 in Bowser's budget for that purpose. The last element, Madam Chair and members, is the Bowser budget does not continue to include the technical support for the drainage work group. They are holding a position vacant that was to provide significant support for the drainage work team efforts. If you look at the state and you look at the significance of drainage in Minnesota and its relationship with water quality, you can clearly understand the importance of looking at new and innovative ways to deal with drainage systems as they move forward in their maintenance, improvement, and management if we're going to effectively address our water quality issues in the rural areas of the state. So we would also, again, ask your consideration for maintaining the integrity of that technical support in Bowser for that drainage work team effort. Madam Chair, that concludes my comments, and I would stand for any questions that committee members may have.
Mr. Harnack, thank you. That was very, very informative. On this commission, the Boundary Commission, did you say what the contribution is from the various other states and Manitoba?
Manitoba contributes $100,000 from their state government, and then the coalition of local governments contribute another $100,000. And the same exists for Minnesota. The state of Minnesota contributes $100,000, and then on behalf of all the local units of government, the Red River Watershed Management Board, through its levy, contributes a matching $100,000. North Dakota and their local governments do the same. South Dakota's is apportioned. It's not a total $100,000, but it's apportioned based on their area within the Red River Basin.
Okay. So you think this would jeopardize the continuation of that cooperative relationship?
I believe it certainly would, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it. We're about out of time, so if there's anyone else who wants to testify, comment on the budget or other recommendations, just contact our office, and we'll schedule at a later date. For now, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you, members.